I should have given you a bit more information about some of the things. And two things in particular. When dealing with the charge conjugation operator, so you have the charge conjugation on the spinorial index acts like something like that. Well, sorry, it's a sigma 2, right? Now, this is a quantum operator. So taking the complex conjugation of the creation and annihilation operator inside, the psi is not something that obviously well-defined. So if you think of this as complex conjugate as the dagger and the transpose, then the dagger acts in the usual way on the creation and annihilation operator, and the transpose acts on the spinner matrix indices. Okay. So that's number one. The other thing is that the charge parity, or the C parity, associated with a photon is minus 1. And this actually comes from the fact that the interaction Hamiltonian or the interaction Lagrangian between electromagnetism and, between photons or the electromagnetic field and a Dirac spinner is of this form, where A mu is the electromagnetic field. And under charge conjugation, this guy has minus 1 parity. Therefore, the photon field also must have minus 1 for your theory to remain invariant under C. So at some point tomorrow, we are going to promote the A mu's to operators, and they'll continue their own creation and annihilation operator, and therefore a single photon state will have charge parity minus 1. Okay. Okay. Sorry, let me just turn off my phone. Not that anyone calls me ever. Well, actually, that's not true. Marketing people call me all the time. Okay, so those are the points about yesterday's tutorial. I also wanted to mention something about yesterday's lecture. So when we quantize a field, say we've been talking about the spinners, we actually add a new representation to the field. It's an infinite dimensional representation. So what I mean is the following. You do some Lorentz transformation on your space-time, okay? So the way that this Lorentz transformation affects the operators on your Hilbert space of particles is through a unitary transformation. This is something that we know from quantum mechanics. You know, if you rotate your laboratory, all your operators in your theory has to be changed by a unitary transformation. So in this case, psi of x interpreted as an operator acting on the Hilbert space of particles. Remember, psi of x has b dagger and so b and c dagger. So those acts on the state of particles. So this operator acts like some unitary acting by conjugation or similarity transformation. This has to be the case, otherwise our probability amplitudes will not remain positive, or it'll mess up our probability if this isn't the case, right? However, expressions involving psi must also transform in a way that is covariant from a space-time point of view. And for that, we say that S acting on psi. So this is the spinorial representation of the Lorentz group. So this is a finite dimensional matrix. For the Dirac field, this is 4x4. And these guys do not form a unitary representation of the Lorentz group. And they're finite dimensional, so there is no contradiction here. And these guys form a unitary representation of the Lorentz group, but the U's are infinite dimensional. They act on your Hilbert space. So that's something that I want to make sure that you guys understand. So these guys only act, if you expand psi as a Fourier mode, in terms of its Fourier modes, and so let me just write it out. Psi of x has stuff and r. So here you've got b of r of p, u of r of p, e to the power minus I p dot x. And over here you've got c dagger r of p and v of r of p and e to the power plus I p dot x. And all of this is multiplied by some Lorentz invariant measure. And these U guys, U and U dagger, they act on this, the annihilation operator and the creation operator, and for psi bar similarly. Okay. Yeah.
So the U's act on the B's and C's, and the S's then act on the U's and B's.
S's act on the B, U's and B's. So I wrote something incorrect. Yes, correct. Okay, so we sneaked in an infinite dimensional representation of the Lorentz group in the process of quantization. And makes John's sonnet very appropriate. Oh, by the way, a professor of literature, English, at the University of Waterloo is sharing your sonnet with her students as we speak. So you're famous. You should go and hang out in the English department now. So yesterday, let's get back to the business of propagators, and I'll have to go a bit fast. I won't, because then I just leave people behind. So this is, I told you that if you were to evaluate this using the anti-commutation relationships, then you'd get something like this. Where the d functions are functions you saw in Dan's lectures. They're the two-point functions that came from the scalars. But the point is, these guys, so this outside the light cone, this anti-commutator is zero. Okay. So outside, so there, let me just close my brackets. So this guy is zero. If x and y are space-like separated, okay, so this motivates the definition of the following Feynman propagator. So it's a 4x4 matrix. And this is, Han was right. This is how the spinorial index should be. Again, I am reverting to my old habits. And the way that the time operation is defined for spinner is that this expression is but it's and this minus sign is necessary for the propagator, the Feynman propagator, to be consistent with this result. Because this result says, if you take the expectation value of this guy outside the light cone, right, then we get that psi bar, expectation value of psi bar with respect to the vacuum, is equal to minus the expectation value of psi bar and psi, okay? And so you see that outside the light cone, these two facts are ambiguous, right? Because suppose this is x for some guy, y would be in the future, quote unquote future of x if it's outside the light cone. But for some observer, y would be in the past. Not the past, but the numerical past. You know, the y0 component would be less than the x0 component, right? So, so if x and y here are time-like separated in the Feynman propagator, you know, whether x naught is greater than y naught or y naught is greater than x naught is a frame dependent is a statement, right? And therefore, in one frame, and therefore for this, the Feynman propagator to be consistent with this guy vanishing outside the light cone, we have to put a minus sign here. Okay? Yeah.
That's more of a definition of the time ordering.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. We are defining time ordering that way. Otherwise, this would not be consistent with the causality constraint that we derived earlier. Okay. So just following the same kind of footsteps for the scalar field propagator, you can now derive an expression for the Feynman propagator. And I'm not going to do that. It's a 4x4 matrix. And it has the form So a lot of these signs are a bit dependent on the signature of your space-time. And I think this is a plus. Okay, yeah, I think so. And I'm including in here the I epsilon prescription, which in effect tells you, gives you the time ordering prescription. Okay. So what does the I epsilon prescription tell us is that it tells us that how to do the P0 integral. So this is our P0 plane. And our integrand has two poles. One at EP and one at minus of EP, where EP is defined as three momentum squared. So this is a positive root of that, relationship. EP is the positive root. Then if x naught is greater than y naught, then so this is, but on the other hand, if x naught I'm getting a bit carried away with the colors here. Then over here we do the same, but then we close the contour in the upper half plane. So if x naught is greater than y naught, this integral picks up the residue from EP at EP, and otherwise it picks up the residue from minus EP. And I'll leave it for you guys to verify that actually, if you do this integral and you plug this in, you get expressions for the Feynman propagator, expressions for those guys. If you now express psi and psi bar as three momentum integrals instead of the covariant way I've written it, you'll get some expressions for those vacuum expectation values. I'll leave it for you guys to check that those expressions are what something you get when you do the momentum integral. I think you have seen this before, right, in Dan's course, but probably it's a good idea to do this again. No, I might set this as an optional question in today's tutorial, because if you think that you've done it enough times in your life that you don't need to redo it, don't do it. But if you think that you do, then you know it's good to do it again. Okay, so I'm gonna move on to a different topic now. So far, we have talked about free fermions and how to quantize free fermions, and now I'm going to introduce some interactions. We are building up to QED, but following David Tong's approach, I'm going to, before we go on to QED, we're going to develop some of the Feynman rules associated with spinners and fermions in the context of a simpler theory, the Yukawa theory. Okay? So, and it's not the original Yukawa theory that we are dealing, but a slightly different version of it. Yes, like Dan told you about the scalar Yukawa theory. Now we are going to replace the charged scalar by charged fermions. Okay. So yuck. No, it's actually a very nice theory. So where El Dirac now is, it represents not an electron, but a nucleon. And it's, okay, let me first write down the full Lagrangian, then I'll talk about the symmetries. Big M squared phi squared, and then L int minus lambda. So phi is real, but psi isn't. So we, this Lagrangian, including the interaction term, has the symmetry that we talked about, the global U1 phase symmetry. Right? And therefore, the conserved charge, this theory has a conserved charge, a conserved current. The charge that is associated with this conserved current is the baryon number, or nucleon number in this case. It is not electric charge. Okay, that's something that is good to stop and think about for a minute. Is just because you have a U1 global symmetry doesn't mean that it has to be interpreted as a U1 charge, right? So this nucleon could be, for example, the neutron. In that case, you know, it doesn't have an electric charge, right? So if I were to include both neutrons and protons, then, you know, there'd be an isospin symmetry, which rotates, SU2 symmetry, which rotates the proton and the neutron. But anyway, you'll see that in the next course. I won't go too much into that. Okay. Now note that the coupling, what's the dimension of the coupling here? That was a question.
1/1.
So what's the dimension of a spinner? 3/2. What's the dimension of a scalar? What is the dimension of a Lagrangian? 4. So 3/2, 3/2, 1. That gives you 4. Then what's the dimension of lambda?
0.
So such, so operators whose coefficients are massless are called marginal operators. And you'll see that they have some very interesting special place in quantum field theories. You didn't talk about beta functions yet, right?
We did in
okay, right. So when you quantize a theory, these are the coupling constants become, they are no longer a scale invariant quantity. They actually become functions of the energy scale at which you are probing them, which makes physical sense because, you know, at the end of the day, what we do is an experiment at a particular energy scale, and therefore it's not unusual that, you know, the coupling constants in your theory will actually develop a scale in dependence. And so there are three types of couplings in quantum field theory and statistical field theory in general. They're called marginal, which have, you know, classically they are dimensionless, and then there are relevant operators. And for relevant operators, the couplings have negative mass dimensions. For the relevant operators, the couplings have positive mass dimensions. And for the irrelevant operators, the couplings will have negative mass dimension. And the whole idea of relevance comes from the point of view of low energy field theory. That means that when you go to the infrared, when your energies are very low, that the couplings which are relevant, they become large, whereas the couplings which are irrelevant, they're suppressed. And the couplings which are marginal, you know, you have to figure out how they behave depending on the theory. And that's actually a very important subject, because the way that these marginal operators behave in QED is very different from the way that they, behave in QCD. And it's related to the whole idea of asymptotic freedom and confinement, stuff like that. So there's a whole big story there hiding that I'm not going to talk about. But Francois will touch upon that. And you've seen that in StatMech. There's also a version of this in quantum field theory. Just, you know, think there are more to come there, okay? Okay, so we shall be interested in the tree-level processes of this theory. And you've seen tree-level diagrams in the scalar theories. And Dan did a really nice job telling you about the LSZ. I'm not going to go into LSZ. I'm just going to assume that there is an LSZ formula for the Fermi fields as well. And so as a result, I'll treat the asymptotic states to be states of the free theory. Yes, Daniel?
When you said that JMU was conserved, like baryon number or something like that.
Sorry?
You said that JMU, the conserved charge, was something like baryon number.
Oh, well, a nucleon number here.
Nucleon number. And then you said it wasn't like electric charge. What makes something that you want to call it an electric charge?
Right.
So it makes that's a very good question. So suppose that instead of the scalars here, we had photons. We had a spin one field, which was not massive, right? Then it would have a very different interaction term. And it would actually have an infinite range as well, because the masslessness would have to remain, the particle would have to remain even when you quantize the theory. And the reason for that is that electromagnetism has a particular quote-unquote symmetry called gate symmetry, which is broken by masses. And the gate symmetry, when you break it, leads to an inconsistent theory. Therefore, electromagnetism, even under quantum effects, cannot acquire masses. So this is to say that if you were adding electromagnetism here, then you would have a long range force. The L interaction would also be different. Okay? Then we would have a long range force. You know, the strength of that interaction is probably set by experimental values. I mean, we don't know why the value of the electromagnetic coupling is what it is. You know, it is maybe there is some distribution of vacua called a landscape, and we just happen to fall into the one where, you know, E has that value. But the long range nature has to do with the fact that electromagnetism is massless and it's a gauge theory. Okay, now coming back to this theory, Yukawa introduced it to account for the shortness of the nuclear interactions. And he had the intuition that at that point, people did not know about mesons. And he had the intuition that if there was a particle with some large mass, M, so, okay, we are gonna assume that Although we are assuming that the nucleon mass is much, much larger than M, but M itself is much bigger, bigger than, say, for example, the electron. So Yukawa, you know, had the hunch that if there's a massive scalar mediating the interaction of nucleons, then that would have a limited range. And he figured out from experiment what the mass of this nucleon, this meson, should be, you know. So at that point, you know, this was also a triumph of the fact that before this, people did not believe in virtual particles, whereas, you know, the scalar particle acts as a virtual particle in the interaction of two nucleons, right? So this the success of this theory, Yukawa's theory, to explain the low energy interaction of nucleons, you know, had the effect of making the virtual particles more believable. Yes, John.
Particle means short range interaction.
It's some length scale, right? I mean,
a mass is some kind of inversely related to some length scale. It's just very heuristic argument. Yes.
You can use some QED to derive Coulomb's law.
Yeah.
And if we do a similar thing here, we get
the exponentially decaying potential. Yeah. Yeah. I think Dan did that. Did you do that? There was an optional problem in one of your tutorials on that, yeah.
Do you mean by virtual particle?
Yeah, we'll see what a virtual particle is. You saw that in probably in the dance course as well. In the phi cube theory, for example, you have... So this is a virtual particle. So an internal particle that is not on mass shell, okay?
Isn't that on mass shell?
No.
I mean, like, you could have, it's a...
The momentum can serve, but it's on the mass shell.
Okay. What is the time scale for the lifetime of a virtual particle?
What do you mean the time scale?
So if you were to have some scattering and you looked at the time the two initial particles collided and the time that they were scattered.
I don't know if you can associate a time scale to collisions. I mean, we only look at the asymptotic states and stuff happens in the middle. I mean, there is a time scale associated with decaying, unstable particles. But I don't know if I can associate a time scale. Maybe there is. I don't know. Ilan?
So if Yukawa was trying to describe nuclear interactions, why did you have to propose a mediator instead of saying that the nucleons interact directly?
Then that would be point-like. I mean, if you integrate it out, if you're only at a very large distance, then, of course, I mean, you can always integrate this out. At a much lower energy scale, you won't see the meson, of course. So there, so for example, the Yukawa would be, so this is the scalar field, right? So you could phi 4, yeah. That's a good question. So. Yeah, that's kind of an irrelevant operator, but yeah, you could. But you know, that's. I mean, people work with effective theories with their irrelevant operators all the time. But it just means that you have to have introduce an energy scale for this guy, and that actually dictates up to what energy scale your theory will be valid. Yes, I'm going to take one more question, and then I'm going to move on because.
I guess I don't know the difference between an internal particle and a virtual particle, if those are both, I guess.
I think they're the same.
Okay.
Yeah.
Same word.
Yeah. Okay, so
what I want to say is that as a consequence of an analogous LZ theorem for fermions and we'll treat asymptotic states, states of the free theory. And that we're in the interaction picture, so the creation annihilation operators satisfy the same algebra as in the free theory, then the scattering elements, so if we have an initial particle going to a final particle, the matrix elements, I think there's a conventional I here, if I'm not, are given by the final states and the time expectation, the time ordered product of the exponential of I, the interaction Hamiltonian in the interaction picture. And this is the initial state. Oh, it's minus one. So we're excluding the identity because we're only interested in states which actually go have some scattering. We are not interested in particles which just like don't scatter. Okay. Oh, when you expand it, there's a one right here, right? Which tells you that nothing, which quantifies, you know, nothing happened, the probability of nothing happening, amplitude. Okay, so David Tong does a very nice calculation of the nucleon scattering. So I think it's really worth doing. So I'll start that calculation. I won't do it in all its gory detail because it'll probably take about an hour to go through all the algebra. But I'll just do a few steps. And then in today's tutorial, we'll do a similar calculation and in all its glorious and gory detail. I don't know why glorious and glory. I guess, yeah. Depends on your point of view, I guess. Even people who like quantum field theory think those details are gory. It's actually nothing, not very gory compared to, say, some of the computations you have to do to work out RG flows and stuff like that. So when loops are involved. Okay, anyway. So let's nucleon scattering. So I hope people remember now what these expressions are. If you don't, then you have been sleeping. Let's see if I can remember them. Okay, and a convenient notation for the two parts is psi plus of x and the psi minus of x. So psi plus of x is the positive frequency mode, which contains e to the power minus I p dot x. And this has the annihilation operator b, and this has the creation operator c dagger. Similarly, we can expand psi bar as psi bar minus and psi bar plus. And this has the creation operator for the particle, and this has the annihilation operator for the antiparticle. And similarly, we have phi of x, and phi of x has, I won't write this out. This is a real particle, so, okay, let's just do this. Okay, we can, I'll need the. And this here, life is simple. The good old days before spinners were imposed on us. And this bit is phi plus of x. And this bit with the measure is phi minus of x. Okay. And so what is happening is that two particles, psi particles, are coming in from infinity. And one of them has spin S polarization and has some momentum, say, P. Let's put four momentums here. That's convenient. The other one has polarization S and R and some momentum K. And when they come close to each other, stuff happens. We don't really know what this stuff is. We can calculate it, though. And then they go away, and there are detectors which detect some momentum K and some spin S prime and R and some momentum P prime and some spin R prime, and these are also psi particles going out. So this is kind of my. So the Feynman rules will make this much more precise. So our in state is a two part is B dagger S and B dagger R of P acting on the vacuum. And our final state is B dagger S prime and k prime and a b of r prime p prime acting on the vacuum. Then f final, which is the ket, this is a ket, has a the ordering gets interchanged because of the Hermitian conjugation. Okay. And our, I'm going to drop the interaction picture labels. So our interaction Hamiltonian is of this form. And there is a normal ordering, or well, I should really put a, yes, normal ordering. Okay. Now the first thing to note is that the expansion of the Dyson series there, the order lambda term is zero. Why? Sorry?
Only one phi. You were saying something? No, say something. Don't be scared to speak out. I'm wrong all the time.
There's only one person.
Sorry, you mumbled there.
There's only one meson.
Yeah, exactly. There's only one meson operator. And this is sitting inside a normal ordering.
So this is not contracted with anything. So this will either, you know, crush the incoming vacuum, well, annihilated, or the incoming states, or annihilate the final state, right? So we have to, for non-trivial process contribution, we have to look at order lambda squared terms. And in the order lambda squared terms, we can now, you know, expand psi and psi bar and phi in terms of their plus and minus components. So we get 8 terms, and then we can use we can use Wick's theorem, and I don't think I told you about Wick's theorem. Okay, for fermions, by the way, you can probably guess what Wick's theorem is. So, let's put a card here. Yeah, this will be a normal ordered. Plus. Okay. So this is sometimes. This is sometimes written as psi x, psi y contracted. But if you interchange psi y and psi x, you will get a, you'll pick up a minus sign, okay? Okay, so coming back to our calculation, when you look at the lambda squared term, in the Wick's theorem, only the terms which have phi and phi, in which the meson is contracted will contribute for the same reason, because it cannot have an uncontracted meson operator, because that meson operator would, annihilate the in and out state. So this is to say that the amplitude from the lambda squared term, so this 1 over factorial of this prefactor comes from the exponential expansion. And I'll put F for final. And there will be 2 integrals. And from the first interaction Lagrangian, you'll get this. And from the second, the x2, where 1 means that their argument is x1 and x, the arguments are x1, okay? And here, psi bar of psi, it's 2, so that's x2. And multiplied by phi 1 and phi 2. Okay? So this is what we have. So it looks simple enough. Takes about half an hour to calculate. But that half hour is worth doing, because then at the end of that half hour, you appreciate Feynman rules a lot more and how Feynman saved so many hours of our lives. As Schwinger said, I think it was said, that Feynman brought quantum field theory to the masses. I think Gell-Mann and Feynman went to the same primary school or something. So whenever Gell-Mann got some big prize, Feynman's mom would write him a letter. Feynman, like, hey, Gell-Mann got this big prize. So I think when he got the Nobel Prize, he wrote back or something. Or something like that. I forget the exact details of the story. There was competition between the two, let's just say. I can imagine that the Feynman and Gell-Mann's mother, you know, trying to outdo each other about their sons in their Long Island, New York, Long Island accent. Okay, so now expanding out, let's do one thing. Let's expand out the size in terms of their mode operators and do the normal ordering. So we get rid of the normal ordering sign. But because they're fermions, we see that this guy has to be commuted once to get it over here. So you pick anti-commuted, so you pick up a minus sign from there. So there's a minus sign from normal ordering. And there's minus sign inside the bracket. And there's f, and there's d4 of x1, d4 of x2, and there's d cubed of k1, d cubed of k2. These guys come from the expanding out the psi, the two psi's, and there is 2 pi 6 4 e of k1 e of k2. And there are two sums, which t prime and t, which are the spinner indices. And given what the external states are, these are the ones, the minus ones are the ones that will survive. And then we have psi 2 of u of t prime. I'll explain in a minute what this formula is. There's an exponential coming from ik 1 dot x1 minus ik dot 2 x2. And then the annihilation operator, which comes from expanding out the size. And then there's t prime of k2. And now what the initial state was, it was bs of k dagger and br of p dagger acting on the vacuum, okay, times psi 1 and psi 2. So these u's and these exponentials and these first two annihilation operator come from expanding out these two psi's. Okay, now it's a few lines of algebra to evaluate this. But when you do, it's minus 2 pi 6 4 EK EP delta TS delta T prime R delta 3 K1 minus K delta 3 K2 minus P. And another term with a minus sign with T replaced, exchanged with T prime, and K1 interchange with K2 times the vacuum. Okay. So now we have, so this is basically we get by using the anti-commutation relationships to get the annihilation operators to come and act on the zero. Yes, John?
I'm ordering and normal ordering relation. Why are, I guess, why is in the contracted term neither of them psi bar, or should one of them be psi bar?
Sorry?
In the SF x minus y, it's just the contracted psi x psi y.
So what do you mean what this is?
So right.
Sorry. This is Okay. Okay, so now we can do the K1 and the K2 integrals using the delta functions here. And we can also do right. And we can also do the T and T prime sums. Then this thing becomes equal to minus minus I lambda squared by a factorial of 2 d4 of x1, d4 of x2, and then the final state, I'm writing it out now, is BR of P prime BS prime of K prime, and minus psi minus 1 contracted spinorially with this, Psi 2 contracted UR with P. And then there's exponential of minus I K dot X1 minus I P dot X2. And then plus the same thing. There's a bar here. Nobody told me about that. Caught me on that. And then here you have an UR of P. Again, you have the psi 2 of minus, and here you'll have U of S of K e to the power minus I P dot X1 minus I K dot X2. Bracket ends. Vacuum, phi 1, phi 2. Okay. It's better than a lullaby to put you to sleep. Okay, so now you have to expand psi 1 and psi 2, psi 1 bar and psi 2, and do, and they will have annihilation operation. You'll have to do the same calculation as this one. Creation operators acting on this guy, and do the same thing again. And then you get something from the first term, which I will write down in a minute. But it turns out what you get from the second term is exactly the same. And these two terms cancel the 1 over factorial of 2. And if you were to do this sort of computation to the third order in lambda, there would be 6 such terms, and they will cancel the 1 over factorial of 3. Okay? So, right. Okay? So what is that term? Okay. Okay, I think I'm gonna skip a step here, guys. It's just like becoming painful there. So what I'm gonna do is that I'm gonna express psi bar, the two psi bars in their Fourier modes, and then I'll pick up delta functions from doing the anti-commutation relationships, and then you know we'll do the k integrals, the sums, and then we get so we'll pick up two more exponentials from those expansions, but remember that the propagator of phi 1 and phi 2 has in it another exponential. So after we have collected all the exponentials, we do an integral over the dx1 and the dx2. And remember that when you expand the phi 1 and phi 2 propagator as a Fourier expansion, it'll contribute its own momentum integral, right? And that momentum integral is what will be left over until the very end. And in the end, we'll also do that momentum integral. And then we will come to this a final expression, which I'm going to write down now. Sorry, that kind of would have taken me 15 minutes to do. And it's just not worth classroom time to do that here. Okay, so you guys need to finish this calculation on your own. It's really straightforward, and you can't make a mistake here. It's so straightforward. I've done it twice, and I've not made any mistakes even once. I mean, for me, that's a miracle. You know, usually if I do a calculation twice, I have 5 or 6 mistakes. So, okay. So what is this? This is going to be minus I of lambda squared, 2 pi 4 from the momentum integrals, all these integrals. We have an overall energy momentum conserving delta function. And then inside we have the spinner contractions, R prime, P prime, U of S of K. So this is a scalar. And then we have U bar, S prime, K prime, U of R of P. And multiplying this is the propagator for the scalar, which is K prime minus P minus big M squared plus I epsilon. And then we have another term, but there's a minus sign. So note now that, this is S. And here you have U bar of R prime, P prime, U of R of P divided by P minus P prime squared minus M squared plus I epsilon. Okay. Okay. So how do we interpret this? So the first term, we can think of it as, remember that there was a particle coming in with momentum p and some spin r, and then what went out was, it, you know, we detected another particle with momentum k, k prime, and say spin s prime. Right, so this we can, this is this bit. And the other bit is a particle coming in with momentum k and spin s and going out with momentum p prime and r prime. And the propagator for the scalar field so we can think we can diagrammatically represent the first term like that and the second term similarly we can diagrammatically interpret as by convention, we'll keep the same momentum labels on the left-hand side. So a particle coming in with P and R, and a particle going out with momentum P prime and R prime. So this is this factor. The left side I'm keeping, that's the convention, yeah. So this is coming, so this arrow is telling me how the momentum is coming in and how the momentum is going out. I'll talk in a little bit what the other arrow is for. So K of S, this is K prime of S prime. And so here we have going down here is P minus P prime momentum. Okay. So this we associated with this diagram. The arrow on the fermion lines reflect the flow of charge, the E1 charge. So if you have a theory with fermions or a charged particle, not fermions only, and you are drawing Feynman diagrams and their arrows, the arrows have to always be consistent if the charge of the theory is conserved. If you have a point where the two arrows are like going in, then either you have made a mistake in your calculation or that theory doesn't have a conserved charge. So in diagrams involving Majorana fermions, it'll happen. So for example, where charge is not conserved. Okay. Yes, Nadav? Right above the P minus
P prime. Sorry? The P minus P prime, the second
term. The squared?
This guy?
Yeah.
Yeah?
This one you wrote above.
Yeah?
No, I'm just asking, in the parentheses, what's the index that you wrote above?
What is the index I wrote? Sorry, I don't understand the question.
In the denominator, P minus P prime,
yeah.
Is that to the power of 2?
Just trying to understand your handwriting.
The 2 is turned sideways.
Looks like a new.
So then the other one should also be.
You know, have you read Alice's Adventure, Alice Through the Looking Glass? Okay. And you know Humpty Dumpty, you know? He makes words mean what he wants them to mean, not what is generally understood by the meaning of words. And as a result, words, he has to pay them a lot. You know, on Sundays, the words come around and they form a huge queue outside his door waiting to get paid. So I make numbers mean what I want them to mean. All right. I just hope that I don't have a great fall or something. Anyway. Yeah?
So by charge, by U1 charge, do you mean the Noether's charge when U1 symmetry is conserved?
Exactly.
So how do you define the charge for a theory where it's not conserved?
Oh, you just, you can have the same operator and you pretend it's not conserved, but you can have the same operator, right? And it'll have some states will have eigenvalues of that, but interactions will not preserve that charge. Okay. If you ask me, I don't see the point, but hey, I don't do particle physics. Okay, so this allows us to extract our first set of Feynman rules for fermions. Okay, so what are the Feynman rules? So number one is, okay, when we write down an amplitude, the convention that Dan and I are following, we don't include the 2 pi to the power 4 and the delta, overall delta conserving momentum. That's probably that's included in the cross section, measure, the phase space measure of the cross section, okay? So for the Feynman rules, I'm going to give, will not involve the overall delta function, but we are going to conserve momentum at each vertex. Okay. So number one is that incoming fermion, So for me, time usually goes from left to right. So incoming fermion, the arrow means the fermion is going in. And there is some interaction vertex, but we'll come to that later. And the momentum is going this way. And there is some spin associated to it. We write a factor of U of P. The second one is outgoing fermions. Have a factor of, so this is the diagram out, so it's going out there. We associate a factor of U bar R of where P is going this way. So when you have a diagram like that, what you have to do is pick one of the fermion lines and go against the arrow while you write from left to right. So for example, for this diagram, left, for the top line, I would write down, I'll start from the end. So it's an outgoing fermion. So I'll write down U of bar, and that has spin S prime, and momentum K prime. And then the incoming fermion is U of RP, right? So I followed the arrow in the opposite direction while writing from left to right. Some people like following the arrow's direction and writing from right to left. I find that difficult in the English language. So having done this, you know, when you write it like this, this guy comes out very nicely as a scalar object, because this is a spinner, this is the conjugate spinner, okay? So that, for me, that is a Feynman rule. Some people would not include this. So follow the arrow in the opposite direction. So now, in the last 15 minutes, I'm going to calculate the two antinucleon scattering. Now, I'm not going to do that, but you can imagine it'll be very similar. But now, if you were to do this, then you would get the following Feynman rules. Incoming antinucleon or antifermion, which will have arrow like this. So conventionally, when you have an antifermion going in, the arrow comes out. And so the momentum is going in like that. And for this, you have V bar of P, so which is, so you, it's opposite to what you had for the fermion. So that's number four. And number five is when you have an outgoing antinucleon, you have ER of P. Okay. Then we have, Sorry? Did somebody say something?
Okay. Sorry.
Okay. Good working?
Yes.
You know, in some Middle Eastern countries, if somebody invites you for dinner and you don't burp after dinner, that's considered really bad manners. Yeah. Okay. Number six is that for each vertex, you put in a factor of minus I lambda. For each internal line, then I would say, impose momentum conservation at each vertex. So the internal lines so this is my scalar. Associate with them a the momentum space Feynman propagator. I'll try to be careful with my twos from now on. Similarly for the fermion. Okay, now I come to something very subtle, or slightly subtle. Is these two diagrams, contribution from these two diagrams, there's a relative minus sign. And that minus sign came from Fermi statistics. And remember my convention that I said that I want to have the same momentum labeling for the left, for the incoming particles. So when you have, when the outgoing particles are identical, you know, this you know, you can get the final momentum labels, momentum and spin label, the final momentum labels as from a finite, from an even odd number of permutation from the final momentum labels here, right? You just flip this. Some people, to emphasize this, draw these two, if you want to keep the same final momentum labels here, then you draw these two diagrams like so. So you're crossing the fermion lines once, and that picks up a minus sign. So, but there are other cases which are a little different from this, which we'll see today in the tutorial, where there's also a relative minus sign, where there is no obvious crossing of the fermion line. Okay, and that is when the your particles are actually distinguishable, and we'll see that. So number 9, I'm just going to say, is introduce minus one, you know, for Fermi statistics and then in today's tutorial, there will also be a short problem about number 10, is that fermion loops will also come with a minus 1, factor of minus 1. And then the final rule, which doesn't change for what you saw in the scalar quantum field theories, is that integrate over any undetermined momentum. So for example, I'm just going to use this. If you had a meson coming in, it can break into a fermion-antifermion pair. And the incoming meson had momentum P. Then this has momentum, say, P plus K. And then this has momentum minus K. But we don't know what the value of K is. We just know that they must add up to P. That's an undetermined momentum. So there would be a Feynman rule where minus 1, because it's a fermion loop, and then there would be a d4 of k. Okay. And am I missing something? They're probably like a scalar. No, I think that's it, yeah. Okay, so I'll take a few questions.
I have a question about the relative minus sign for the Fermi statistics.
Okay.
I see why we have to put a relative minus sign in. And I also know that since if we're just looking at this matrix element by itself, then when we get a probability from it, we'll square it out and it won't matter which one we put it on. But if we're adding together different diagrams.
There's interaction.
Right. Okay. So how do we know where to put?
It doesn't matter if you put it on the front first one or the second one.
But if we add this to a different, if we like go to the next order and try and find like the total.
Right. You have to be consistent.
Oh, what you're,
Right, I see.
You know, we are going to do a problem like that today. It's a bit in the tutorial where we actually do see that a diagram which has the same end states the same end state? No, it's not the same end state. Okay, so I don't exactly follow your question. You're probably saying that how do we ensure that we have higher order diagrams coming in?
Yeah, I mean, you say you have to be consistent, but like when there's more diagrams, it's not. Actually, I think I kind of see it, because higher order diagrams. Never mind. Sorry.
I think it's a valid point to worry about.
As long as there's like two incoming particles and two outgoing particles, so just, you know, pick, you know, like say P and R are always coming on top, and then we'll say it's plus if K and S are on top and minus if
P
and R are on top.
Right. So, you know, one way I think about it is that this picture makes it clearer. So for me at least, so P and K comes in. And so you have some detector here, right? And the detector detects K prime and detects P prime. And so although these are written in momentum space, if these are Fourier transform of something happening in position space with integrated over all the position, so you can kind of say that the first particle came in with momentum P, and it was annihilated at the point where the particle K prime was created, okay? Where the second particle came at K and at the point where the particle P prime was created. Whereas here, the two points get interchanged. So when you look at the operators which do that, you know, we have two sets of operators, psi 1 and psi 2, from the second order. When you're there is an additional minus sign coming from, you know, ordering these annihilation creation operators, you know, appropriately to do this job. So when you keep that in mind, I think that you can actually have when you're careful about that, you can actually have a consistent way of assigning the minus signs. Granted that this doesn't, you have to kind of get into the nitty-gritty of the interaction Lagrangians. But you know, it's worth doing to keep that minus sign. You know, you don't have to keep track of all the delta functions and all the exponentials. So it's not that difficult to track that minus sign just by looking carefully at the ordering of your operators. Okay, but I think that's a very valid point. But if you keep that in mind, you know, by order in calculation, you should be fine. But okay, anything else? Okay, so today we'll do some practice sessions with Feynman rules in the afternoon's tutorial. Right. And then we'll, tomorrow we'll start on the electromagnetic field, the free electromagnetic field.